Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Armando Aguilar-Lopez, pro bono counsel for petitioner Eduardo Cortez-Rodriguez. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. This case, Your Honors, is about the agency misapplying the law, making erroneous factual findings, and abusing its discretion to deny relief to Mr. Cortez, a man who was tied, beaten, waterboarded, suffocated, and subjected to electric shocks by cartel members and police officers. Today, we ask the court to remand based on errors in two of the agency's overall findings. First, that Mr. Cortez's conviction is a particularly serious crime for purposes of withholding of removal. And second, that he does not meet the requirements for protection under the Convention Against Torture. Now, with regard to the particularly serious crime or PSC determination, the IJ first erred in finding that California's second-degree burglary falls within the ambit of a PSC. And as a brief threshold point here, the board has created a two-step framework for determining whether a conviction is a PSC. First, the court determines whether a conviction falls within the ambit of a PSC. And only when the answer to that initial question is yes, can the IJ proceed to the second step, which looks at the facts and circumstances of the conviction. Here, a crucial error made by the immigration judge was at step one. The IJ relied on a Supreme Court decision discussing something akin to California first-degree burglary to impose what effectively became a categorical assertion that second-degree burglary...
But how is that a misstatement of... You're referring to Taylor?
Yes, Your Honor.
How is that a misstatement of the law?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the misstatement here was that the IJ pointed to Taylor that deals with first-degree burglary for the assertion that second-degree burglary necessarily or inherently involves a risk of violence. But because Taylor involved first-degree and not second-degree, a broad assertion could not support the second-degree burglary analysis without the judge explaining why, if something is true about first-degree burglary, that also is necessarily true in second-degree burglary. And I think here what made matters worse is that the California Court of Appeals has explicitly stated in discussing California first-degree and second-degree burglary that there is a difference, that the second-degree burglary doesn't have that peculiar risk of violence. And here, rather than correcting the mistake, what the board did is that they affirmed the IJ, specifically they affirmed the IJ's reasoning, and then they repeated the mistake, citing another Supreme Court case, a decision that similarly describes first-degree burglary. Now, I want to be clear here that the agency could certainly reach the decision that second-degree burglary falls within the ambit. But what's missing here is the why, the explanation why, especially when they're presented with California precedent that says otherwise and contradicts the reasoning. But even here, if the agency was not determined to have erred at step one, and I think the court could remand on that issue alone, on the legal error alone, the agency here also erred at step two. And so first, when moving on to the case-specific facts and circumstances, the IJ continued relying on Taylor, on the reasoning of Taylor. And by imposing a heightened and inapplicable level of inherent risk, the IJ restricted herself from being able to apply the correct case-specific analysis that is required by precedent. But additionally, even aside from the legal error at step two, the agency relied on factual findings made based on speculation or conjecture. Namely, one, that the gun Mr. Cortez temporarily held was stolen. Two, that he discarded the gun in, quote, a public thoroughfare. And three, that Mr. Cortez believed that someone was inside the house when he chose to enter it.
Counsel, can I move you to the CAT argument and specifically to the position that the agency has taken that that the relocation is a problem? Why wasn't that a sufficient basis to say that everything was fine because he was able to relocate and live within the country, and therefore denial was appropriate as to CAT?
Certainly, Your Honor. So, yes. So I think as a threshold point as to relocation, this court has affirmed time and time again that there is no determinative factor when it comes to the CAT determination, that every factor can be considered in the aggregate and that all evidence must be considered to determine whether that likelihood burden is met. But here, the IJ's determination, specifically on relocation, rested in large part on the assumption that because Mr. Cortez is no longer involved with the cartel and was harmed while he was involved with the cartel, that he is unlikely to be harmed in the future. But here that determination is directly contradicted by the record. Mr. Cortez only began selling marijuana for Los Viagras when he was threatened to be killed if he refused. And when he did try to stop selling for them, what they did was they kidnapped and they tortured him for an entire week. So in addition to that error that the IJ made, the agency failed to account for Mr. Cortez's own history that also contradicted another of the IJ's conclusions, that Mr. Cortez's likelihood of torture at the hands of Los Viagras was speculative because he was not harmed, threatened, or communicated with by cartel members after he fled to Mérida. But his own history in Mexico is evidence that the absence of harm by the cartels, even if for several years, that does not equate to safety, as he was not targeted by Los Viagras until approximately 5 years after he returned to Mexico.
But you're basically asking for a de novo review. Here, you know, it's much more deferential. And why isn't it? Substantial evidence supports the agency's view that he's not involved in the criminal activities anymore and he wasn't harmed for almost 7 years. Therefore, he doesn't face, risk of future harm or torture.
Well, I think, Your Honor, there's also a specific factual findings that the IJ made that are not supported by the record. And just one example of a misstatement of fact, for example, that could certainly have impacted the IJ's analysis is in her decision at AR 88, when describing the risks Mr. Cortez faces by the Sinaloa cartel, the IJ states that Mr. Cortez was living there for over two decades. That's a quote, over two decades. And I would just dismiss that as maybe a typo. But then again, later in that section of the decision, she repeats that Mr. Cortez had a two-decade residence in Mexico. And so at a minimum, she's relying on facts that aren't supported by the record. And so that could be a basis deeming that the internal relocation had sufficient errors to warrant remand. But as we described in our brief, there are several other issues in the IJ's determination regarding CAT that also warrant remand. One crucial issue that I'd point the court to is, first, that the IJ imposed a too narrow of a standard for torture. After being waterboarded, tied, and beaten by Los Viagras cartel, Mr. Cortez was detained by state officials. And while in official custody, masked men tied him up, beat him, suffocated him, and subjected to electric shocks. The abuse was so severe that Mr. Cortez lost control of his own body and urinated in his pants. It became so unbearable that he asked the perpetrators to kill him. At one point, one of the masked men warned the other that Mr. Cortez might die. And in response, the other simply responded that if he did die, they'd simply just throw his corpse into the ravine. This treatment plainly fell within the meaning of torture. And in finding otherwise, and relying on the absence of one, significant ongoing physical harm, and two, a subsequent experience of physical injury or wound after the mistreatment, the IJ, in effect, imposed a requirement of ongoing subsequent harm here. And she also ignored simultaneously Mr. Cortez's testimony that later, once confined, he was coughing blood from what he believed was damage to his lungs from that torture by the state officials, and that when he sought medical treatment while in custody, he was denied that treatment.
But didn't the IJ say, even if, you know, and I think I agree with you on this point, but the IJ did say, I think, even if this constituted torture in the past, that he hasn't shown, risk of future, a risk of torture, because he lived from 2015 to 2022 in a location peacefully, and he stopped associating with criminal elements.
Well, Your Honor, I think so. So, an initial point there is, I think there was that determination that he could simply be safe because he stopped associating with the cartels is contradicted by his history. He didn't choose to work with the cartels. They forcibly recruited him, and the IJ acknowledges that they forcibly recruited him. And so I think that factual error shouldn't be relied on to reach the ultimate determination.
I don't know if that's an error. I think that's just how you interpret the evidence and the import of that evidence. And we have to give deference to the agency's interpretation of that evidence or conclusions from that evidence.
Certainly, Your Honor. And I think here what should be noted is, again, the framework that courts have applied to determine whether CAT is warranted and whether the burden is met. And I think what courts have clarified time and time again is that relocation is but one factor. And additionally, because of the internal relocation errors, the factual errors that are made, ultimately the IJ can't reach the conclusion. You know, one of the CAT requirements is that the IJ aggregate the cumulative risk of torture. And here, because of the errors that the immigration judge made, she couldn't possibly have aggregated it correctly. And we have other instances, for example, where the IJ states in conclusory fashion that she's done something. So, for example, when discussing the aggregation analysis and her requirements to aggregate, in her decision, the IJ states summarily or conclusory, in a conclusory fashion, that the standard is what it is and that she claims that she has considered the evidence in the record cumulatively. But on the recitation of the standard here doesn't necessarily mean that it was applied correctly. And I think what this highlights is that when there are factual errors present in the IJ's determination, at a minimum, what this court's precedent requires is that the IJ explain how she reached that conclusion, and that a general statement that she has considered the evidence in the aggregate simply won't suffice. One other error that I wanted to highlight in the IJ's decision that also factors into that cumulative analysis is as to acquiescence. Here, the IJ misapplied the standard. She faulted Mr. Cortez for not reporting his harm to the authorities and failed to meaningfully engage with substantial evidence in the record of widespread corruption, impunity, and collusion. The evidence included, but was not limited to, direct statements from cartel members that they were in touch with local authorities. The evidence, therefore, compelled the conclusion that at a minimum, local officials in Mexico would more likely than not remain willfully blind or even collude to the torture. And just some examples of this that I'd like to highlight is Mr. Cortez credibly testified, for example, that he directly witnessed that Los Villagras cartel members had or possessed vehicles with government insignia. That was at AR 231 of his testimony. Two, he was told directly by Los Villagras that they have, quote, support from the local government and that the government, quote, were not going to do anything to them because they were colluding with them. And then three, when Mr. Cortez's cousin, who was later murdered by the cartel members, went to the police for help, they turned him away because they said he was involved. And then finally, the Knights Templar cartel members who attacked him while he was in criminal custody came up to him after the attack and told him directly that they had assistance of the prison guards. And I think what's notable there is that the prison guards stood near them as they said those threats to Mr. Cortez, and that's at AR 300. And so I think all of these together, all of these errors together, including the errors as to relocation, clarify that at a minimum, the IJ could not have possibly aggregated these correctly. And so we would request that this court reverse the PSC finding, the PSC determination, and remand so that the IJ could properly consider the withholding only under the INA claim, and then also remand to correct the misapplication of facts and apply the correct legal standard as to the CAT determination. And if there are no further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Judge Lee. May it please the court. Daniel Mumolo on behalf of the United States. This petition for review presents a straightforward basis for denial. Eduardo Cortez Rodriguez unlawfully entered the United States on two occasions, committed...
Counsel, let me interrupt you there and just jump right into it. Do you think that the BIA got it right when they said he was not subject to past torture?
Well, I think... Again, I think the treatment, I guess there's two issues here, so or two circumstances or scenarios. So one is the kidnapping and the treatment by the cartel. You know, that's private actor or behavior. That's not with the acquiescence or participation of the government. So clearly no there. In terms of the kidnapping by and the detention by the police, admittedly, I think that's a closer call. I think the treatment, you know, to the extent that's true, is deplorable. But I think that the immigration judge correctly concluded that this court's test for what constitutes torture is very high. And in fact, if you look at...
So hold on. Waterboarding, beating, kidnapping, there's a question about whether or not that's torture?
Again, I think that, you know, in common parlance, I think that we're conflating maybe what common parlance is and what the regulation says, Judge Mendoza. I think if we look at this court's precedents in cases like Hernandez v. Garland, in cases like Sapansi Salazar v. Garland, this court has concluded that more pronounced and detentions of greater duration did not constitute torture.
So you're telling me we're going to have to publish to make clear that this is, in fact... torture?
Well, again, I think that this is also something that is within the substantial evidence standard. So you'd have to determine that a reasonable adjudicator would be compelled to conclude that the past treatment was torture. But if I may, I mean, again, I think that even if we concede for the sake of this argument that the past treatment did constitute torture.
Well, didn't the IJ assume that too?
I
assume for purposes of the argument that even if this constitutes torture in the past, there's no risk of future torture.
Exactly, Judge Lee. And I think that two things on the past torture. Again, like I said, you know, I think the treatment, you know, is deplorable, and the IJ said as much. But if I'd refer this court to its own precedent in Dawson v. Garland, that past torture does not give rise to a regulatory presumption of future torture. And CAT is a forward-looking form of protection. And, you know, past torture, admittedly, is one of the elements. But it is a forward-looking form of protection, and the IJ and the BIA and its affirmance.
Well, it's not just forward-looking. It's the most important factor that must be considered. We have said that, haven't we?
Well, again, I think this court has said that it is a primary factor. I think that it's not dispositive, and I would push back on that. It's the factor that dictates the analysis. CAT at bottom is a forward-looking form of relief, and you know, past torture is one of the factors. But just as important as that factor, I would argue, Judge Mendoza, is the ability to relocate within the country. And if you look
at counsel, actually, I'm gonna push on that a little bit, because in Avendano Hernandez versus Lynch, we specifically stated, and I'm quoting, past torture is ordinarily the principal factor on which we rely when an applicant who has been previously tortured seeks relief under the convention, because absent changed circumstances, if the individual has been tortured and has escaped to another country, it is likely that he will be tortured again if returned to the site of his prior suffering.
Thank you, Judge D'Alba. And again, I don't dispute the holding in that case. I guess a couple of things I would say. It ordinarily does not mean always. And the petitioner in this case specifically lived within Mexico for nearly a decade.
Let's talk about that. When he lived in Mérida, didn't he talk about thinking he was being stalked? And didn't the IJ and BIA find him to be credible?
So two things, I guess. So he lived in Yucatan from 2015 to 2022. And I believe that the petitioner, Cortez, stated that in 2019, he noticed some cars potentially following him or tracking him. Or it's a little unclear exactly what they were doing. But all agree, and no one disputes, that no one from those vehicles ever approached him, ever contacted him, or ever threatened him in any way. You know, in terms of the credibility question that you asked, Judge D'Alba, you know, yes, the immigration judge did conclude that, you know, his narrative was internally consistent. But again, I think that, you know, you have to look at what the factors of CAT relief are, and subsumed in that is the substantial evidence standard. And, you know, even, you know, this court has held that even if the record evidence can lead to two divergent conclusions, that does not mean that substantial evidence fails to support the finding here. The court would need to conclude that a reasonable adjudicator has to be compelled to reach the contrary conclusion. And we have an exposition from the immigration judge here that is roughly 40 pages long with all of these findings. And at bottom, this CAT claim is really just a disagreement about the weight of the evidence. And respectfully, this court is not allowed to reweigh that evidence. So again, I think that for all of those reasons, the CAT claim, you know, is without substance.
And primarily, your primary argument is because of relocation. That would be your primary argument, correct?
Yes, I think relocation is a primary argument. I think changed circumstances is another argument. Cortez has specifically stated that he has left that lifestyle behind, the drug lifestyle, the gang lifestyle, and all of the, to the extent the previous incidents constituted torture or not, I think we can all agree they constituted severe mistreatment, but all of those were during a time in his life when he was affiliated with or participating in that lifestyle. So, yes, I would agree that relocation is the primary basis for that, and that's what the immigration judge said, and that's what the Board of Immigration Appeals affirmed, and, I think that's more than a compelling justification for it. I guess if I maybe will rewind a little bit, if we go back to the PSC, the particularly serious crime determination, I think there was some discussion about that may be worthy of clarification for the court. Cortez's burglary conviction was a particularly serious crime because even second-degree burglary under California law presents the potential for a violent confrontation. And the particular facts and circumstances of Cortez's offense confirm why. By his own admission, he entered a residence, stole a firearm, and narrowly avoided confrontation when someone returned to the home. He then discarded that firearm, further endangering the public, and the agency reasonably concluded that this offense was particularly serious and barred withholding only relief. And there was some earlier discussion about the citation of Taylor v. United States and what exactly was going on there and, to what extent the agency relied on that. I guess a couple of things I would say about Taylor for the court. The agency did not use Taylor to supply the particularly serious crime standard or to import this the sentencing enhancement analysis from that amendment to the Armed Career Criminals Act categorical approach. We cite Taylor and the agency cited Taylor for the limited but albeit very important, I would argue, proposition that the Supreme Court has recognized that the dangers of a violent confrontation are associated with burglary. And that analysis or that discussion in Taylor and repeated in James was in no way limited to aggravated or first-degree burglary. Burglary always carries a risk of a violent or dangerous confrontation with an occupant, caretaker, or other person. To be clear, and I concede, that the odds are necessarily less when burglarizing a vending machine or burglarizing a locked automobile, but contained within the California burglary statute, even second-degree burglary encompasses the burglary of a commercial structure. And there are occupants in a commercial structure, there are caretakers of a commercial structure, and, again, I'd refer the court to Mendoza-Garcia v. Garland. And the only thing that needs to be asked, and I think there's some mischaracterization potentially from my friend on the other side, that there doesn't need to be a conclusion that second-degree burglary always entails a violent confrontation. The analysis that this court deploys is whether the elements of the crime potentially bring the crime into a category of a particularly serious crime. And for all of the reasons stated, like I said, the probability might be lower with commercial burglary, but it's not zero. Even the burglary of a locked automobile is not zero. It might be way less and much less than burglary of a home, but that's the only clarification that I think is really worthy of emphasizing for the court, because like I said, the standard is whether it potentially falls into the category of a particularly serious crime.
Counsel, just going back to the relocation, do I have it right that he credibly testified that he had to quit his job as a result of what was happening when he was in Merida?
My understanding of the record, Judge Mendoza, is that he was working as a traveling salesman, door-to-door salesman, when he was in Merida. I'm not sure I'm familiar with this idea that he had to quit his job, but you're saying he had to quit his job because he was afraid of the cars following him, or?
It's my understanding. Is that not the case? Again, that's my question to you. Do you not have that as
I guess I would say that, you know, even to the extent he had to quit his job, I'll concede that, you know, assuming that is correct, you know, I still do not think that his subjective fear of a car following him that in no way threatened him led him to quit his job and then illegally re-enter the United States gives rise to...
But you indicated in your briefing that this was a peaceful existence in Mérida, Yucatán, which, by the way, Mérida is beautiful and would be... great to be having a peaceful existence there. But if you're having to hide inside your home and quit your job, I'm not so sure that's a peaceful existence, as you've indicated in your briefing.
Well, again, I think in terms of the peaceful existence, that was a finding that was made by the immigration judge. And so, again, not to beat a dead horse, but I think that we're all subsumed and contained and confined within the substantial evidence standard. And so even to the extent that the petitioner suggested that he had to quit his job for that reason, that does not establish affirmatively a greater than 50% chance that he will face torture if returned or removed to Mexico. And I guess a few things about the relocation record while we're on that topic. Cortez resided safely for nearly a decade there without sustaining any harm. The immigration judge did mention this quote that you said, this relatively peaceful existence. That's at AR 85. Cortez similarly testified that he used his real name to get a job. So again, I think that, you know, to the extent there was some subjective fear, it's belied by all of the other findings by the immigration judge. One other point, again, not to keep reversing back, but I guess I'd just go back to one more thing about the particularly serious crime standard. Again, I think there's some confusion here about this court needs to apply a two-step, two-factor test. That is simply incorrect. The analysis that this court uses is the analysis that was articulated in Chamouk v. Garland and reiterated in Bear v. Barr. It's a three-factor test under the Frantescu analysis that involves the nature of the conviction, the type of sentence imposed, and the circumstances and underlying facts of the conviction. So my friend on the other side in a 28J letter has urged this court to follow the guidance of Martinez v. Blanche in the Fourth Circuit. That's a recent decision there. A couple of things about that. That decision sharply departs from the precedent of this court and Chamouk v. Garland and Bear v. Barr. And similarly, the Fourth Circuit decision was also over a forceful dissent by Judge Wilkinson that said that the analysis and the majority opinion sharply departed from the totality of the circumstances that courts across the country typically apply. And if there are no other questions, I'd ask the court to deny the petition for review. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. So I'd just like to make a brief point about the two-step framework. I think this court in Mendoza-Garcia made very clear that it's not the Ninth Circuit that's creating this two-step framework. It's actually the board in matter of NAM, and they're simply just affirming that that is indeed the framework. And I think Mendoza-Garcia lays that framework very, very explicitly, saying that only when the elements bring you within the ambit that you then proceed to the factors that are of the specific circumstances of the case. The other point that I'd like to make on the PSC is we're not saying that the IJ could not have reached the same conclusion, that it does fall within the ambit. And my friend on the other side explains very well why that might happen, how the IJ might reach that conclusion. But what happened here is that the IJ did not say that. The IJ did not explain herself and analyze the elements. She simply cited to this first-degree burglary case without further explanation. And so this court is left without the ability to be able to determine whether that reasoning is the reasoning that she would employ if she applied the proper test. And just a brief point on relocation, Your Honors, that I'd just like to note. Mr. Cortez did, in fact, testify that, and this is, I believe, AR 246, that he tried not using his name for anything, even a job. At some points, he was not able to do that, but he did go into hiding while in Mérida. And additionally, just to point out, the record also states at AR 247-248 that quitting his job, one of the reasons why he did that at Bimbo was because he believed that he was being followed. There were other reasons such as COVID, but he did testify credibly, I might add, that that was the case. And so for those reasons, if there are no further questions, we'd ask that the court remand, reverse the PSC determination and also the CAT determination, and then remand so that the court can apply the proper standards.
Great. Thank you. Thank you both for the argument. It's very helpful. Case is submitted, and we are recessed for the day.